Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to delve into a controversy that really has people's tempers flaring. It's the diet controversy, and we're going to talk to a person who I've discovered has a very, very balanced perspective on the diet controversy. She's written an excellent book, great title, Death by Food Pyramid. Love that title. Denise Minger, who you can hear laughing in the background, is a health writer, and she's a frequent lecturer. She, by her own description, is an autodidact, someone who has pored over the field of nutrition with a great deal of dedication, pouring through complex nutritional literature and boiling it down so that it's understandable. And she has written some great blogs on the subject of the China study, which is often invoked as the Bible of the vegan or vegetarian movement. I don't confuse those two terms because all vegetarians are not necessarily vegans. Vegans are simply a variation, more restricted form of a vegetarian diet. And we're going to talk a little bit about vegetarianism, raw foods, the China study, and have a free-ranging discussion. So welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast, Denise. It's nice having you as a guest.
Thank you so much for having me on.
And, of course, let's mention up front your website. Catchy title?
That's right. Yeah, rawfoodsms.com.
Raw foods, raw food or foods, plural?
Singular.
Okay, I didn't get that. Was it foods or with an S or without an S?
Raw Food SOS.
Raw Food SOS. Okay, great. So, well, first of all, you know, a little context. Recently, I wrote an article in it's actually a website called Mind Body Green, very popular website, health website. And it was on the subject of the China study and vegetarianism and a recent study that appeared in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition that suggests, and this was a study done in Asia, that suggests that the China study, which is thought to be a justification for vegetarians worldwide, may have some flaws in it, that actually this re-evaluation of dietary patterns in Asia suggests that animal protein consumption may be beneficial in terms of cardiovascular disease and cancer instead of the reverse. As Colin Campbell states in the China study. So give us some context. First of all, you know all about the China study. You've been all over it. You've read it. You've analyzed it. Tell us what that is.
So the China study was a very gigantic epidemiological project that was conducted in rural China. It was kind of spanned over several decades, 1970s and 1980s. And basically what happened was a group of researchers headed by T. Colin Campbell, they went into China into 65 counties that they selected specifically because the people in those counties ate the same kind of diet from birth until death. You know, they didn't hop on, like, South Beach and then Atkins and then whatever from week to week like we do in America. They actually ate a very consistent diet, which makes it easier to see the long-term effects of certain food choices.
So it's a gigantic living laboratory for studying the effects of diet.
Exactly, at least from an observational standpoint. It's not really something that can prove cause and effect, but it's a great starting point for looking at different dietary trends. So it was actually a very interesting study, and you know, even though I ended up critiquing it quite a bit, the study itself for that type of study was actually very well done, and I think it's a gold mine of information. So anyway, so they went into these counties in 1986, and in each county, they surveyed residents of that county in terms of what they had been eating for the past year. They also took some data based on what they observed while they were visiting, you know, like a day-long diary of different foods that they measured and weighed and just tried to document very, very meticulously. And then along with that, the researchers took just a great deal of data based on people's blood markers. They did a lot of blood work, urine analysis, just to see what was going on internally within these residents. So after that was all said and done, they matched up the dietary patterns in each food. It took some complicated statistics, and they matched that up with the mortality patterns that were also occurring within each county. And so from that, they drew, it was, I believe, over several hundreds of thousands of correlations between different dietary variables, different blood markers, different health outcomes, just a ton of data. It just really compiled a great wealth of information. And so that is all interesting. But the problem with when you have a study that is this huge, and I believe they documented something like 365 variables or something so close to that, which is a lot, the problem when you have that much information is that you end up with a ton of correlations, many of which may or may not be valid, and anytime you have an idea and kind of bias going into that that network of information, it's very easy to cherry pick and prove whatever it is you're trying to find and whatever it is you're believing in already.
So first of all, that's what may have happened with the study. So tell us about Colin Campbell, because Colin Campbell, he's a very respected academic scientist. He has a PhD. I believe he teaches at Cornell. He's now professor emeritus, which means, it's like knighthood for a professor. And he's, well respected in the field of nutrition by some who don't challenge his beliefs that we should be more on a vegetarian or plant-based diet. Tell us about that project that he undertook. And, when people quote Colin Campbell, and they, when you have an argument with a vegetarian, they'll immediately say, well, you have to read the China study. I mean, first of all, it's the size of a doorstop. It's a huge book. And right. You figure all those facts are so weighty that they can't possibly have a flaw. They can't be wrong. And therefore, the argument ends, and they say, just read it, because that's the gospel.
Right. That's actually that almost verbatim what you just said is what I was receiving over and over again from vegans. Just a brief history of myself. I was a vegetarian for 10 years and then ran into quite a few health problems when I went vegan and raw vegan. And so by the time I was late teen, I had reconverted, I guess, to omnivorism and integrated some animal products back into my diet. But at that point, I really became interested in helping vegans who were struggling. And so exactly what you said, whenever I would go and try to just explain my own story and how I felt that at least a small amount of animal products could be incredibly beneficial, I would receive that same response, which is that, no, you must be wrong. Just read this book, read the China study, because this guy has a PhD and you don't.
Right.
And so that's the big reason that I went back to the original data and looked at it, because I wanted to know what was going on, because I got so frustrated with that response. So that's what you're asking. So T. Colin Campbell, as you said, has an amazing laundry list of credentials and experience, and his position is kind of unique, because he started as a dairy, or he grew up on a dairy farm, and he grew up believing that animal protein was wonderful and that we should be eating lots of it, and that we should be finding ways to improve our food quality so that it has more and more animal protein, because that's what's going to make it healthy.
So in a way, he may have the passion of an apostate. There's nothing, for our listening audience, I think Denise knows what I'm saying, but an apostate is someone who's renounced their previous religion and has adopted a new religion. And there's nothing like the fervor of an apostate, someone who grew up, with basically slaughtering animals and drinking a lot of dairy products, and suddenly has found fault with that paradigm and has raised a new banner. It's a little bit like what's that guy's name? Robbins. He's the heir to the Robbins ice cream fortune, and he's
Robbins, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's not Tim Robbins. That's the actor. But
Tony. Yeah.
Yeah, but Baskin Robbins. That's the ice cream company that makes 31 flavors, and he was heir to that fortune, and he's come out as an ardent opponent of dairy consumption in his books, subsequently as a vegan. Look, this is sheer speculation. I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm trained in internal medicine, but there's something about that kind of background that sometimes adds fuel to the passion for dietary proselytizing.
I think that's a very keen insight. I think that happens to quite a few of us, not even, health experts, but just a lay person as well.
Yep.
I think what you just described is probably a big part of what happened. And then in addition to his whole belief system, having started as being pro-animal protein. When he was working in the Philippines in the 1970s, his goal back then was to increase animal protein consumption within these countries that were facing malnutrition and starvation in certain areas. And what he found when he was in the Philippines was that he came across a paper by some Indian researchers at the time who had been conducting studies on rats using the animal protein from milk casein. And what these researchers were doing was they were exposing a bunch of rats to high doses of aflatoxin, which is a carcinogen that tends to induce liver cancer. And after they did that to the rats, they would feed the rats different levels of this animal protein casein. And what the researchers found or reported to science was that when the rats were eating high levels of casein, about 20% of their diet, they would develop precancerous lesions in their livers. And shockingly, though, when the rats were fed only 5% of their diet of casein, a much lower level, they were evidently free from those tumors. And so when Colin Campbell came across this information, he was quite intrigued by it, especially because, you know, he was out here in the Philippines trying to increase animal protein consumption, and here was a study, albeit on rats, that was
that seemed to cause cancer. So, okay, case closed.
Right,
I mean, yeah. these are wonderful animal experiments. You feed these rats a known poison, which is aflatoxin, which comes from peanuts. By the way, a lot of people that I encounter in America are concerned that aflatoxins in peanuts makes them cause cancer. But from what I understand, aflatoxins are very, very carefully regulated in the United States. And this is actually one instance where we can somewhat trust our government, because you won't find aflatoxins in American peanuts. You might find them in peanuts in certain parts of the third world where the peanuts are not processed properly or they're left to mold, you know, like in Africa, perhaps certain parts of Asia.
Right.
And similarly,
yeah.
The last time I checked, mice and rodents don't drink a lot of cow's milk. That's the source of casein. And so, although they do drink milk, but it's mother's milk from mother mouse or mother rat, which may or may not contain a foreign type of, well, probably doesn't contain a, it does not contain a foreign type of casein. It contains a type of protein that is specifically designed for nurturing baby mice and rats.
Right, yeah. So yeah, there were definitely a few problems with those studies, many of which you just mentioned. And in addition, what was not known at that time, but was that we now understand, is that when any creature, for the most part, is fed a diet that's low in protein, especially a protein-deficient level, what happens is your liver enzymes end up decreasing in their activity. And what that results in is when, say, you have these rats, one that's fed a protein-deficient diet, one that's fed adequate protein, the protein-deficient rat, the reason it's not developing cancer is because its body can actually not break down the aflatoxin it's been exposed to because its liver is essentially malfunctioning. And so instead of developing tumors, what happens is we see acute aflatoxin toxicity, and instead of getting cancer, the rats generally just die. And so that was a little nugget of information that was kind of left out of this whole rat experiment exposé that Campbell wrote about in his book. And
yeah, I mean, given a choice of either getting cancer or dying, I think, you know, I'd take my chances on a cancer, because death is, you know, pretty definitive. And, you know, I'm being facetious here, but, you know, what we're saying is that you're between the devil and the deep blue sea. If you eat too much protein, you might court the risk of cancer. If you have insufficient protein, you will dramatically reduce your risk of cancer, no question, but you might also court the risk of other types of problems that could lead to death.
Right. And on top of that, if we look at other forms of protein, even other forms of milk protein like whey, we've also conducted a lot of experiments on rats using whey protein, not necessarily with aflatoxin, but with other toxin exposures. And what we find is that whey is actually protective against tumor
mm-hmm.
growth.
Yeah.
And so if you think about it in a whole food perspective, if you're eating, drinking milk or any dairy product that has both dairy or that has both casein and whey, is that effective casein that we see when it's isolated still going to be relevant? Is it still going to be even showing any harm, or is the whey actually going to work symbiotically with the casein too?
Right. Actually, I mean, there are various whey protein drinks that are considered health drinks because they deliver the building blocks for glutathione. They're considered detoxifiers or energizers. They're certainly utilized by people in the sports field as recovery drinks after intense exercise.
Right, yeah, so there's definitely that component too.
So what you're saying is that using these rodent studies as a way to prove that cancer is caused by dietary components like dairy and or meat, it's not really conclusive proof that meat causes cancer or that dairy causes cancer in humans.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of a giant leap to take those animal studies and not only say, okay, these apply to humans, but say that casein can be representative of all forms of animal protein. And just there's just a lot of leaps that have been done between those two points that would actually need more evidence to be filled in.
So are you familiar with the more recent study that was done that appeared in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition? I think it was this year, which looked at dietary patterns not just in China but across Asia, which found that the addition of animal protein not only was not causative of cancer and heart disease, but to some extent was protective against cancer and heart disease. There was a study, and that's actually what I alluded to in the Mind Body Green article. When some people read it, they were very angry. They reacted sometimes, you know, 'cause there's a comments section under the article, and they said this can't be true. Was the study, were these studies performed by the meat board or the dairy board? Actually, the studies were performed by United Nations commissions and independent scientific bodies. They thought that the makers of Oscar Mayer wieners were underwriting the study to get vegetarians to consume more hot dogs.
Wow. Yeah, it's very interesting the kind of feedback that, you know, the article you wrote would receive in different communities. And obviously I've had similar experiences writing my China study pieces and receiving, you know, I got death threats after I wrote that.
Really?
And people become very attached to my beliefs, almost like religion.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, you were once a vegetarian, correct?
Right.
Did you ever write anything in favor of vegetarianism?
I don't know if I wrote anything in favor, but I was definitely...
The point is, did you ever receive any death threats from meat eaters? You know, say like when you're in high school and, you know, the guy on the football team, walked by and did he like shove you in a corner and start bullying you because you were on a vegetarian diet? I'm not sure that the reverse is the case.
If it ever occurred, I've blocked it from memory.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure that I never experienced anything like that. Mostly with people feeling you know, oh, wow, I wish I had the willpower, you know, to give up.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, I think it's unusual phenomenon where people on a clean diet that is natural, plant-based, I think a new term for a plant-based diet is a flexitarian diet. That means that you have the flexibility to include some animal protein, which I'm all for. That's another way you can do it. Okay. That people from that community tend to be sometimes the most dogmatic and sometimes violently so in defense of their beliefs.
Yeah, definitely been my experience as well.
So what are some of the other concerns about the China studies? Is there anything else that we need to take away if we're having a debate? And I think you've probably entered into these debates either in public or in your blogs about the merits or lack thereof of the China study.
Right, yeah. So basically some of the things I found when I was looking at this original data, and for anyone out there who's not quite sure what that means, there's a book called, I think, Diet, Lifestyle, and Mortality in Rural China. It's 900 pages of correlations that were conducted straight out of the original data after the researchers collected it and published in this book that's available to the public if you do a little digging for it. And so what I did was I spent about 2 or 3 months just poring over these numbers and conducting my own statistics on the things I was finding in there just to compare what I would find with what Colin Campbell was reporting in his book. And so some of the most interesting things I found were that, kind of echoing what you just talked about with that recent study, meat consumption was not associated with heart disease. In fact, even blood cholesterol levels were not associated with heart disease. And the one food out of everything that was documented that had the strongest link with any disease was wheat. And that link was with vascular diseases like cardiovascular disease, heart disease, stroke, I think some neurological disorders as well. And so I found that fascinating because when I was reading about the China study in that book, The China Study by Tikhon Campbell, there's no mention of this finding with wheat. And I did a little more digging as well, and I found that Campbell himself had actually either co-authored or was the primary author of a paper that had also explored this link between wheat and heart disease, and he offered in that paper some possible mechanisms for explaining that correlation. And again, I was just completely left out of the book that was designed, you know, for public consumption. The only way you'll find this is if you do some digging in PubMed and look through the you know, the science papers that most people never penetrate.
Does the word cherry picking come to mind?
Yes, it does.
Okay, because sometimes, you know, yeah. you pick and choose the data that supports your argument. And, you know, we all do this because I think everybody in the nutrition field has a bias. There was a really great piece this weekend, and I don't know if you got a chance to see it, by Gary Taubes, T-A-U-B-E-S, who's written some very important articles challenging the low-fat diet orthodoxy. And in this, it's actually an op-ed in the New York Times. Basically, what he writes is that the state of nutrition research is woeful because we've been asking this question for decades. What is the best diet? What's the best diet for heart disease? What's the best diet for diabetes? And what we have is a cacophony of opinions that are based on very slim data. And he points out that it's very hard to test dietary hypotheses because you can't, you know, herd people into camps and divide them into two groups, one group on one diet and another group on another diet, and supervise them with armed guards to make sure that they're following the diet, and then keep them incarcerated for 10 or 20 or 30 years until diseases emerge. It's very hard to do this nutrition research, but what he's really, in essence, begging for is news that we can use on the nutrition front that'll help to resolve some of these bitter controversies. Because, you know, with all this research, we've only grown more divided. I mean, we have the Caswell Esselsteins, you know, and we have, you know, the Dean Ornishes of the world who recommend very, very low-fat, low-protein diets. And then we have, on the other hand, we have the Lauren Cordains of the world, the people who advocate paleo diets, or we have another extreme, Dr. Atkins, who says eschew carbohydrates completely, go into ketosis for health. And most recently, the incarnation is Dr. David Perlmutter, who wrote Grain Brain, who advocates getting rid of grains altogether. And, you know, what we've got is, you know, it's like the Tower of Babel. It's a lot of problems.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think my stance on this, too, is that part of the confusion and part of the reason we haven't reached a resolution, on top of not having the kinds of studies we would really need to find something conclusive, is this idea that maybe there's not a single diet that's perfect for everybody,
right.
And maybe that's why you can put different people on the exact same eating regimen and they will have different results. You know,
yes.
I talked to a lot of people who've gone paleo, for instance, and the husband will be shedding pounds and feeling great, and then the wife finds that she's gaining weight, and they're eating the exact same foods, and they can't figure out why they're having just different responses. And so I think there's a big case to be made for just different, you know, genetic components, different issues with their health histories, different gut flora issues, just a whole host of things that can influence what foods are best for each person.
Right. This is actually an idea that I tried to get at in my first book, which was written in 1984, called The Diet Type Weight Loss Program. And I tried to, you know, look at diets along the spectrum of low fat, high carb, to ultra low carb, high protein. And along that spectrum, try to give people ways in which they can find their way to the ideal diet. Well, that was now 30 years ago or more. And, you know, the book is obsolete, not a print. But clearly, you know, we need better signposts and markers to guide people to the optimal diet. I don't think the blood type diet suffices. I think that there's some good ideas there, but I don't think blood type is the end-all and be-all of determination of what you should eat. Nutrigenomics, you know, as you mentioned, genetics, that there's certainly some very promising avenues there, but it's not ready for prime time. I don't think it's possible to take a blood test or a saliva sample and determine which diet is best for you. I don't think we're there yet. One of the things that kind of bothers me about the China study is that unquestionably what we're seeing in China is a developing nation, which was relatively pristine and cancer-free, a third world country, in, you know, say prior to the 1960s or 70s. Cancer statistics relatively low, heart disease statistics vanishingly small. And now, apparently, with the introduction of Western foods in the guise of meat and fat, we're seeing an explosion of cancer. We see an epidemic of heart disease and diabetes, and the beginnings of catching up to the United States and the Western world in obesity. And we could easily say, look, this is what happens when you start introducing meat. They were eating like rice and vegetables, and they were doing fine. What's wrong with that line of reasoning?
So this is a classic case of confusing correlation with causation. So this is a big issue in statistics and any form of science. It's this idea that we can observe two things happening at the same time, but just because we see those things happening at the same time doesn't mean that one of them is causing the other one. Because whenever there's a situation like that, there's often a host of other variables that we may not have measured, we may not even notice. And so in the case of, say, in adopting a more westernized diet that's higher in animal products, you have to think about all the other changes that are occurring alongside that, which includes a reduction, perhaps, of traditional foods that are nutrient-dense, definitely a greater increase of refined sugar intake, refined grains, wheat consumption is probably going up as well. The entire diet is really changing, and so to focus singularly on that increase in meat intake or fat intake or whatever, it's kind of missing the big picture. And so to draw a conclusion from that kind of observation, it's just premature. You really have to test things at the more experimental level rather than just observing, okay, meat consumption is going up and these people are getting sick, so therefore that is causing that.
Well, another thing that's happening is, that you don't take into account when you look at these correlations is that the air pollution is terrible there. The industrial pollution of water and food is horrible. There's so many adulterants that go into food and even baby products in China that, you know, we may see an uptick in cancer, but it's unclear whether it's related to diet in part or at all.
Right. Yeah. So there's that component as well. You know, physical activity as well.
Right.
Definitely the pollution issues. So much changes usually coinciding with adopting a more westernized lifestyle.
So clearly, if people want to read your comments on the China study, because, you know, maybe they're involved in frustrating arguments with their vegetarian relatives or friends, and they want to be forearmed with some counter arguments, where can they go for your thoughtful blogs and writings on that?
Sure. So on my website, rawfoodsos.com, there's a section, it's a little tab at the top of the site that says the China study. If you just click on that, it's where I've compiled links to all of the things I've written on my blog about the China study. I have quite a few posts on it. So for anyone who's interested, you can go there and just read what I've written. And unfortunately, it's pretty lengthy, but I might put up a summary at some point.
Great. I mean, but you've got lots of ammo there and food for thought, if you'll excuse the pun.
Yeah.
All right. So now let's turn to your book, Death by Food Pyramid. And the subtitle is How Shoddy Science, Sketchy Politics, and Shady Special Interests Ruined Your Health and How to Reclaim It. First of all, great title. Congratulations. And,
Thank you.
And I thoroughly agree with you. I've taken this position for a long time. So what did you find when you investigated the history of the food pyramid?
So when I first got into this, I really didn't have a strong understanding of the history of our food guidelines, so it was kind of a fun adventure doing the research for this. And I would say one of the most interesting things I found was that, okay, so we had our food pyramid come out in 1992, and it had that classic 6 to 11 servings of grains at the bottom, I think it was like 3 to 5 servings of fruits and vegetables. I can't remember the exact number, but it's a pretty classic image, and I think most people who grew up kind of around the same time I did, or, you know, maybe a decade or so before, we've all been just inundated with this figure, this image, even though it has been retired by the USDA. So my whole thing, when I started, I was just assuming, okay, this was they put this together in the 90s, and that's what happened. But when I actually started digging deeper into the history of this, I found that the roots of that food pyramid actually date back to the 1970s. And what happened was the nation had been following this guy called the Basic Four since World War II, pretty much. And back then, diseases were predominantly things like infection, malnutrition, deficiency problems, And when this previous sleep guide had been created, it was with the mind that Americans can improve their health by eating more, mm-hmm. eating a bigger variety, right. and just protecting against diseases of deficiency. We
right.
have
Actually,
this skyrocketing rate.
Excuse me, historically, they discovered in World War II that a very high percentage of the men they were trying to draft into the Army were 4F because of malnutrition. I think it was like 20% of them were underweight and clearly malnourished because there were pockets of extreme poverty in America. This is after the Depression and after the Dust Bowl and, with poverty in the South and Appalachia and certain parts of the industrialized cities where men were unemployed, is that they couldn't find enough guys who were well-nourished enough. And so they had to perk up their nutrition to get them into fighting shape. And so this was historically a concern, is how to avert malnutrition, hunger in America.
Right, exactly. That's a great point. In fact, the RDAs that we still use today, those were implemented and created and studied back during World War II, specifically because the nation was having so much trouble finding people to draft who were in that, shape to fight. And so that's kind of where that whole understanding of, okay, what do we need to stay healthy, what levels of these vitamins do we need, that's where it roots back to. So I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah, so back then, it wasn't an issue that people were suffering from high rates of diabetes or obesity or heart disease. It was that people were malnourished. So back then, that kind of food diet made a lot of sense, and it was effective for the time period it served. But by the 1970s, America was starting to see these skyrocketing rates of heart disease and cancer and all these modern chronic diseases that had not been a problem before. And so the USDA figured, okay, well, it's time to revamp our food diet. And this one woman named Louise Light, she was working as a teacher at New York University at the time, a professor, and the USDA recruited her specifically to be the next person to create the new set of food guidelines and to do the research and to understand what kind of new food choices can Americans be making to improve their health in terms, in the light of these new dietary and disease shifts that we've been seeing. So she went down to a place called the Beltsville Agricultural Research Center in Maryland, again working for the USDA, and her whole mission was to research, read all the papers available linking diet to disease in any capacity, convene groups of experts to help hash out this whole dilemma of what Americans should be eating. And so she spent a solid year working on this project. And at the end of it, she had come to the conclusion that the best direction for America and what she felt would still be economically feasible would be to create a new food eating system where the predominant, it shouldn't actually make a food pyramid, but if we had drawn it as a food pyramid, fresh fruits and vegetables would have been at the bottom. And then she was not fat-phobic at all. She felt that cold-pressed oil should be used liberally, things like flaxseed oil and olive oil. She recommended, still consuming some meat and dairy. And the most interesting part was that she thought that grain consumption should be strictly limited. And she thought
that's very different than how the food pyramid turned out.
Exactly. It was almost the exact inverse of how it ended up being later on.
Huh. It's like the food pyramid stood on its apex, on its head.
Exactly, yeah. And so that it was quite shocking, comparing that to how it actually came about. But the interesting thing that happened during her experience there was that she had recommended in her guide that grain consumption be limited to two to three servings per day. Three servings for people who are very active, for larger men, two servings or less for people who are less active. And she felt that a higher starch consumption than that would be very detrimental to American health.
Wow.
And so she submitted this whole food guide, and she also said that any type of refined grain should be used extremely sparingly. She was very anti-refined.
And this was in what year again?
It was the early 1970s.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so her experience there was that she created this great new food guide. She outlined everything in a way that she felt was very scientifically based, and she submitted her new plan to the Secretary of Agriculture. And to her horror, when that document that she submitted came back to her, it had been, as you said, kind of flipped upside down. It had been completely mangled, And the USDA, behind the closed doors, and Louise White never really got to see what happened exactly, they decided that fruit and vegetables were interchangeable with grains, even processed grains, for whatever reason. I still don't understand that logic. But they decided it would be cheaper for Americans to eat a larger grain consumption and limit the fruits and vegetables down to like 2 to 3 servings a day. And so instead of the food guide that she had designed, where it was, you know, very bottom-heavy on fresh foods, fruits, vegetables, cold-cut fats, the USDA had basically turned it into a very grain-centric food guide.
Well, and, you know, I sense the influence of politics here, because we're talking about a federal agency. And, you know, the USDA is a funny agency because, as you know, it is not an agency that is solely devoted to health promotion. I mean, that's one aspect of its mission statement, but a conflicting and sometimes contradictory aspect of that is that it's also devoted to promotion of agriculture. And sometimes
right.
promotion of agriculture, you know, agricultural profits, is not necessarily consonant with optimizing Americans' health. So maybe, you know, a little, some strings got pulled, some parts of that report got redacted, and big agricultural interests won out.
Right. I think that's the most logical conclusion we can come to. And it kind of goes back to this idea of when the when the USDA was first implemented, which was, I believe it was the 1860s, Abraham Lincoln signed it into existence.
Wow.
Back then, you know, promoting agricultural interests and human health, they were not that conflicting at the time. Because, again, we didn't have this giant epidemic of diseases. We didn't have the kinds of foods that are, you know, corn, soy, and wheat-based across the board that we have today. Back then, it was more farmers were producing foods that were good for humans. And so for the USDA to promote agricultural interests and human health back then, it made sense. But as the years rolled on, their mission became increasingly a catch-22, because you really cannot please the kinds of crops that we're emphasizing today and feed those to Americans and expect them to be healthy.
Right.
So I think it's exactly what you said. You know, in the 1970s as well, there's a lot going on with wheat. There was something called the Great Grain Robbery, where Russia or Soviet Union at the time had just bought out massive quantities of grains in a slightly illegal way from the U.S., because their crops had suffered so badly, and then that kind of sent the U.S. on a roller coaster in terms of grain prices. And farmers were protesting, and a lot had to be done to please those agricultural interests to keep them afloat. And so to, you know, promote greater wheat consumption in America in order to balance out profits, I think it's very feasible that that had happened.
Right, and then this vast system of agricultural subsidies, which some would argue subsidizes unhealthy food, because we have a vast surfeit of starchy foods and even foods that can be converted into sugar, like corn, which gets into high fructose corn syrup, thus guaranteeing us a never-ending supply of cheap sugar, which can be incorporated into our junk food.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If you look at any junk food out there, there's really going to be one of those three subsidized foods in there: wheat, corn, soy. In any form, it's kind of phenomenal.
So you also have written an interesting piece with advice to vegetarians, because look, we got to respect the fact that some people are committed and ethical vegetarians. They may do so for religious grounds. They may do so on the grounds of animal cruelty. We have to respect that. Also on environmental grounds, because we know that if you eat plant material, generally that is lower on the food chain. It produces less devastation to the environment. It's more energy efficient. In a sense, it's more ecological. So a lot of people are very committed to this lifestyle for ethical reasons. So do you have advice for vegetarians or vegans on what they can do to make sure that their diet is optimal? You yourself, a former vegetarian, you've done a lot of research.
Right, yeah. So I think, you know, I do believe there's some people, especially with veganism, who are just not going to thrive on that diet. Part of the reason being there's a lot of genetic components that influence our ability to convert carotenes into vitamin A. And so some people who are vegan, if they have certain defects on a few of their genes that are responsible for that conversion, what they'll find is that they're going to suffer from vitamin A deficiency, which includes, you know, infertility problems, vision problems, skin problems. So that there's going to be some portion of the population I believe that's really going to struggle with veganism. But vegetarianism has a lot more flexibility, and even for vegans, some things that I've come across in my own research, especially as I was trying to heal some of my own health problems, are the importance of a couple vitamins, and in particular vitamin K2, which tends to get overlooked by mainstream.
I'm sorry, did you
health.
Say vitamin K as in, let's see,
kitty cat, kitty.
As in kidney?
As in kitty.
A kitty, or,
yeah.
Okay, right,
vitamin,
K. Because that's funny, because that's one that's not often mentioned as a problem with vegetarians. People often say iron and B12, but you mentioned, you single out vitamin K. Okay.
Right, yeah. So a lot of people don't know this because we have two forms of vitamin K. We have vitamin K1 and vitamin K2. Vitamin K1 is found in a lot of plant foods, and we have a fluctuating and kind of individually based ability to convert vitamin K1 into K2. But it really depends on the individual and your state of health and how much is in your diet. And so the thing with vitamin K2 is it's an incredibly useful vitamin. What it does essentially has quite a few functions, but a large part of what it does is it helps ensure that the calcium you eat in your food ends up deposited in your skeletal tissue rather than floating around in your arteries and getting incorporated into plaque. And so this is a great vitamin for dental health, for bone health, for cardiovascular health. And unfortunately, the only vegan source that I'm aware of is a soy product called natto, which is basically fermented soybeans, mm-hmm. and then the vitamin K2 is produced by the bacteria in the fermentation.
Right.
And,
however, it is present in cheese. Cheese does deliver vitamin K as well.
It's in hard cheeses in particular. It's in quite a few animal foods as well, but for people who are completely shunning any form of animal product, your only option, apart from supplementing, is natto. And unfortunately, natto is kind of disgusting.
It's a funky tasting thing.
We love it, but
yeah. No,
yeah,
I used to be macrobiotic, and I used to eat that. I would, you know, it was a really kind of challenging food to eat because it's fermented, and it's, you know, Japanese people are used to eating it, but it's not something that is familiar to Western taste buds.
Right. Yeah. So there's going to be some people who struggle with that.
And you can get it in supplement form.
Yeah, it's if you supplement, there's some, you know, very high quality companies out there. I think mine usually comes from Carlson Labs. So I take that personally because I feel it's a valuable vitamin, even if you're an omnivore. But if you're a vegan or a vegetarian and you're suffering from loss of bone density, or if you're having dental problems, which is something that I experienced quite dramatically, then supplementing with vitamin K2 is a great idea, and I think it'll really help out a lot of people. And along that same line, vitamin D is just imperative. Most of us do not get enough of it, especially if you live at northern climates. I'm over here in Portland, Oregon. You know, I'm sure 90% of the population here is vitamin D deficient.
Yes.
Just because we get so little sunlight.
Especially after the week that you just had, because you guys got drenched.
It was a monster. Yeah, we got some pretty bad storms here. Yeah, it was kind of fun, though. We don't get a lot of snow, but it's exciting when it does. So vitamin D is incredibly useful as well. It can work synergistically with vitamin K2. So I recommend that people, you know, across the board, but especially if you're vegan and you're not getting any from your food, there are some vegan forms of vitamin D3 that they're making right now. And I think they're based on, like, growing mushrooms under certain radiation. I'm not quite sure how they do it. But
I think it's yes, under ultraviolet. You know, if you put it under UV lights, it'll activate the vitamin D.
Yeah. So I think they're doing that quite a bit. Vitamin D3 is a lot better than vitamin D2, as best I can tell from the research. It's more effective. So I recommend that. And then the other biggie, as I was mentioning, is vitamin A. And most people don't realize that there's actually no vitamin A, true vitamin A, in plant foods. It's only vitamin A precursors exist in things like carrots and sweet potatoes, and then your body has to metabolize those and convert them into a usable form of vitamin A. And so for people who have low conversion rates, it's helpful to enhance your beta-carotene absorption by eating like high beta-carotene foods like carrots and sweet potatoes, a lot of vegetables, with a source of fat, and that actually helps enhance the vitamin A conversion. I have a few tips on my blog as well. If you go to rawfoodsf.com, there's a vegan tab that offers some more ideas on how to enhance your conversion there. And then along with that, I recommend, of course, vitamin D12. when I was a vegan, I really encountered some strange arguments about why we don't need vitamin B12 from our diet, like it's in the air or it's in soil, or, you know, if you don't wash your vegetables, you'll get enough from that. And that's just baloney.
It's like a bug might fall into your salad and you'll eat the tiny bug and it'll give you all the B12 you need.
Yeah, that's all you need for 20 years, yeah. So there's some odd arguments out there, and I hope that people will think critically when they hear some kind of vegan expert or health promoter claiming that you don't need vitamin B12, because really, if you look at the studies across the board, comparing omnivores to vegetarians to vegans, you can see the steady decline of B12 levels down to the deficiency level, starting with, you know, pretty much adequate levels in omnivores and very deficient levels in vegans. So I recommend B12 absolutely. It's so easy. Just please do it. And then along with that, you know, there's some things that are coming to the surface in terms of our current research directions, like taurine, which is an amino acid that mostly is found in animal foods. And it's not an essential amino acid, so it doesn't do a lot of coverage, but it may have a function in the human body that's pretty important. So if vegans are out there struggling, they're trying to play around with supplementation, taurine is another option there. And along with that, I just recommend that people avoid high omega-6 vegetable oils and emphasize omega-3 fats rather than those omega-6 ones, because if you're a vegetarian or vegan and you're not eating seafood and you're relying on these vegan steak food products, like soy-based ones especially, or corn-based, it's just very easy to give in overabundance of omega-6 and not get enough omega-3. So just, you know, be very careful with that.
And now there's some vegetarian sources of at least DHA from algae so that you can get that. Although the EPA, I don't know that they've figured out a way to synthesize that from plants yet.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen much on that.
Right. Well, you know, I notice in looking at your bio, I noticed that we share something else in common besides the fact that we're both omnivores, and besides our very rigorous commitment to science, wherever it's going to lead us, because I've had my own dietary wanderings, you know, going from a vegetarian diet to an omnivore diet. So that we share in common. But another thing we share in common is that your bio says that you started college when you were 16. And I also, you said you took extra courses, you begged the principal for mercy, you graduated early. I guess you were bored with high school and you wanted to get out.
I was not a happy high schooler, no.
Right. And I had a similar situation. I skipped a grade and I went to college early, which is maybe socially a little bit, I don't know. I'm not so sure that was the greatest idea, but we both started college at 16.
Yeah,
and
I had the same experience. I looked like I was 12, but I lied and told people I was 18 and I was 16, and it was a little strange.
You grow up fast anyway. But, you know, I must congratulate you because, you know, you're doing a rigorous science investigation of this field that is beset with controversy and beset with bias and some preconceived notions. The battle lines are drawn, and I think we need more of your fair and balanced science reporting and the courage to go beyond labels and talk about the truth when it comes to foods. And, you know, I commend you. For our listening audience, the call to action is go to your website, give it out once again very slowly.
Rawfoodsos.com. And I also have the domain name Denise Minger, DeniseMinger, that will also direct you to my Raw Food SOS page.
Great. Yeah, just if you Google Denise Minger, MINGER, you'll get the 411 on where to get this information. And so we also recommend your book, and that's available, usual sources, online and so on, Death by Food Pyramid. It's a great book, great investigation, lots of facts, and it helps explain how we took a major wrong turn in our food policy. We're only beginning to take corrective action, but as a result of the food pyramid, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of Americans or more, millions, were put at risk in terms of their health. The food industry happy to oblige with low-fat products that undermine our health.
Yep. Good summary.
Thank you very much, Denise, for joining us. And We'll have you on again soon to talk about some issues related to food. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. You've just listened to a free podcast brought to you by yours truly and the Hoffman Center. F-R-E-E is my favorite four-letter word, but these podcasts do involve time and money to produce, and so in the spirit of defraying some of our very real production costs and to keep these podcasts flowing, I'd like to ask you to consider a couple of things. First, if you like what you're hearing, please share these podcasts with your friends and relatives. Our object is to continue the spectacular growth of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast with the goal of attaining 250,000 podcast downloads per month in 2014. I know that with the help of dedicated listeners like you, it'll happen. Second, go to drhoffman.com and click on the store and consider buying your supplements via a convenient internet portal or call the Hoffman Center and talk to one of our friendly supplement advisors. We only stock the very highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere, the very same supplements that I talk about here on Intelligent Medicine and that I prescribe to my patients at the Hoffman Center. And finally, consider becoming a patient at the Hoffman Center. I can personally perform an extensive workup on you, applying all the intelligent medicine principles that you hear about on these podcasts, or alternatively, make an appointment with Layla Mutin, our Hoffman Center nutritionist. You already know her as a frequent contributor on Intelligent Medicine, and she'll provide you with expert advice on diet and supplements. Anyway, thanks for listening and continue enjoying our Intelligent Medicine podcasts.